If, however, the individual includes himself with humanity, he then has certain rights also. He has certain privileges and certain obligations which he must meet in order to get along with himself constructively. Each person examining his own nature and his own temperament should come to the conclusion that he is worthwhile, or if he isn't, that it's time to become that way. If the person should be able to look into his own life and be satisfied that he has done a reasonable job with it. He should not run away. He should not corrupt his body through all kinds of dissipations. He should not have attitudes that are obviously unreasonable. He should not cater entirely to the selfishness of gain, exploitation, or profit. Nor should he put his own happiness above all other happiness. These things are mistakes. But the proper attitude is that we should be happy along with others who are happy. That we should more or less make happiness a stronger rule in our conduct of affairs. We all have a right to be considered significant to some degree. And the better we become, the more thoughtful, wise, intelligent, and kindly we are, the more we have a right to feel that we are of some interest and value to the world in which we live. Therefore, it is not a mistake for the individual to have certain affection for his own inner life, but he should have affection for that part of himself, which Emerson calls the oversoul. He should have reverence and regard for the eternal dwelling in him. And he should be a true and faithful servant of the will of his own soul. And when this happens, then he is qualified to take a serious interest and have a deep respect for his own nature. Because actually, his own nature, in a sense, is an illusion. Well, the fact that the individual is a living creature by himself is a more or less of an illusion. We are alive because life is. We are alive because we are in a universe which is filled with life. And that is one life, one tremendous energy. And that life is truly the life of God. Therefore, the God in us must become part of our daily experience. We must live always as though the special guest of heaven was going to be at our table. We must never do things which heaven would not want to see, because as surely as we live, the heaven in us does see. We should try desperately to please that which is better, to please that which we know to be our true selves, for to the degree that we do this, our own lives are enriched, and we become more useful in the advancement of society. Therefore, in education, we should have the skills that are given by sciences, arts, and philosophies, religions, but we should ensoul these forms of knowledge with the inner consciousness and light of our own lives. Therefore, if we want to become scientists, we can dedicate science to the great scientist in ourselves. Because finally, the great power of life has one of its attributes as science, another as philosophy, another as art, as another in some other branch of learning. But all forms of learning, in the last analysis, are simply aspects of the one divine power. And that divine power flows through everything with skill dedicated to love. Every art and science is an expression of divine love. And if man perverts this, as in the development of nuclear weapons, for example, he is perverting a power and is transforming a love that is there into a fear or a hate or a scheme which he is trying to advance for his own purposes. It is therefore very, very necessary that the individual ensoul the things that he is doing. In the shopkeeper, the parent, the teacher, any art, science, craft that we belong to should be ensouled. And when it is ensouled by a natural love and concern, we will have good lives. Now, some will say it's a big price to pay to have to do all these things, because actually, very often, because of our own ignorance and willfulness, the things we ought to do seem terrible. The things we want to do seem best. But this is only of a seeming. We have to consider another dimension also that nearly all nations and peoples and philosophies and religions have considered, and that is the brevity of human life. The idea that we are going to be able to build a good life in the span of our years and to do as we please most of the time and give little or no thought to the major values of living. And that, and finally, we will settle down to playing cribbage in our old age or something of that nature until we drift out of here. This type of thinking is contrary to everything that is necessary and useful for us. If love was something that died with the grave, if there was no more of it, if it had no existence except in some conscious decision of ourselves in the presence of adversities, probably there wouldn't be any particular value in it, except it would be a much more pleasant world to live in while we are here. But we are right that man is part of an eternal life motion, if we do not cease at the grave, if there is something that goes on, something that is ultimately judged or measured, something that we have to live up to or get over, if there are such values as this that endures beyond the grave, then love becomes the most important thing in the whole world, because it is the only emotion that we can take into the presence of divinity. It is like, for instance, if our love is pure and true, our love as we go on into the universe is really the divine love going home in us, fulfilling its eternal purpose, and we become the good and faithful servants. So somewhere in this world there is a standard of excellence, a standard that has been violated from the beginning, a standard, however, which a few noble beings have maintained in public for teaching, and many quiet, simple citizens have lived by throughout their years. There is much more love in the world working than we realize. But we don't hear much about that. Love isn't news. Scandal is news. The mistakes we make become famous. Our virtues apparently are ignored. But actually, whether they are or not is not important. Actually, the important thing is what we are doing to ourselves constantly. It is not important whether what we do is recognized. The important thing is to know that the best in ourselves is being attained, that we are truly going on to something that is worthwhile and necessary for the advancement of the common good. Now, we all need a few props occasionally to kind of make life a little more interesting and meaningful to us. And in the world around us, for thousands of years, men have built great churches. They have built cathedrals and synagogues and mosques and temples. They have done all kinds of things to honor the invisible power of good. And they have established the concept that these sacred places are the houses of good, and they are also the houses of love. In these sanctuaries, it is assumed that man can come in peace and quiet and communion with an eternal spirit that has the power to bestow upon him the peace of God. In the early church, the bishops exchanged the peace of God. It was a representation of the inner fraternity of living things, the realities which we share and by which we become truly one family, one life in truth. Now, all these buildings have influenced people. They are visual representations of dedications of some kind. Many of these buildings were centuries in the building. Some of them probably were built without any great amount of enlightenment in the motives. Maybe they were simply built for selfish purposes or to be a source of being remembered. But regardless of what they were in the beginning, we have come now to look upon them as great enduring symbols of the supremacy of the divine over the human. We therefore build these structures as beautifully as we can. Chartres, Rouen, the Sacré-Cœur in Paris, Notre Dame, all of these great cathedrals are magnificent structures. The light shines through the beautiful stained glass windows. Peace and quiet is seemingly there. A few shadowy figures kneel in prayer. It is a very great quietude. And in those cathedrals, some way, it seems as though spiritual things get closer to us. They do not really, because it's actually our own inner life opening up just a little bit. A door in our own consciousness opens a small way and then closes again when we go back in the secular world. But in these places, there is a peace that has come from dedication and consecration. When a church is built, in most religions, there is a ceremony of consecration. The building is set aside for the worship of God. If for any reason later its religious significance fails or it is no longer needed for religious purposes, it has to have its consecration lifted before it can be used for secular purposes. It must be deconsecrated. Because a building set aside for sacred purposes cannot be just simply turned into a grocery store or something of that nature. And yet we take a world such as we have here, which is a consecrated world, and we change it into a place of merchandise. We do not even bother to deconsecrate it, because we do not realize that it was ever sacred. But all these thoughts come gradually into the mind of the individual who is concerned with life and wants to do a little better job of it. And in these wonderful buildings, you have actually a sense of something superior. I know that some of these churches, the great cathedral of Cologne, was in the process of building for over 800 years, generation after generation. All kinds of strange things happened to it. At one time it was used as a stable, another time as a granary, and once as a storehouse for gunpowder. But gradually these things faded away, and now it is what it was intended to be, a magnificent sacred edifice. Now this, all churches, all temples, and all shrines are in some mysterious way symbols of ourselves. The human being is the living temple of the eternal God. And each of us as a person is a servant in the house of that temple. We must worship at the altar of the divinity in ourselves. Not the mistakes we make, but the tremendous principles and integrities. We were born consecrated. We were consecrated in space before we ever got here. We were dedicated to the service of truth, love, beauty, and God. When we get here, it sort of fades away. Some retain it. Some find it as a result of the journey of life. Some come to it in tragedies of the moment. But actually, the real answer to it is that this consecration is the basis of happiness. Love and happiness are very closely related. And through love, we earn happiness. And as the Arabian Nights Entertainment says, happiness must be earned. It is not something that we are entitled to because we are here. We are entitled to happiness only because we deserve it. And the only way we can deserve happiness is by doing those things which cause it and bring it about and sustain it. And the things that do that, the things that bring happiness to the world, are expressions of love, affection, friendship, regard, unselfishness, service, and solicitude for the sorrows of life. If, therefore, we really want to have a good life, we must, in one way or another, learn that happiness is a product of achievement of that which is good. Almost all of the happiness things that we enjoy today are very temporary in their fulfillments. We want something, it's going to make us happy, we get it. There's that great moment of happiness, and pretty soon we're bored to death. We have to get new things. The beautiful new car that made us so happy we could hardly stand it the day we got it is now generally referred to as the old wreck. It's gone. We have to do something else. The values that we create simply to satisfy appetites of any kind, these values are impermanent. They don't last. They have no reality and substance in them. They are comforts or things of this nature, fulfillments of personal ambitions or personal selfishness, but have no substance. Real happiness has to be useful. It has to come from a life well lived, not from a life devoted entirely to the desperate habit and habit of trying to escape responsibility. So in every way we go along the way, we find that something that is deeper has to come into our experience. In our little squabbles in life, there has to be an element of love somewhere to bring peace. And sometimes peace is quietude. Our Zen brethren are greatly interested in peace, not because it makes them comfortable, but because peace is God's way. If to be in peace is to be in the universe as it really is. So the old Chinese painter makes the beautiful mountains and rivers and bridges, and down in the corner he puts a little man sitting under a tree and looking at it all. This is, to a measure, not simply walking out on civilization. It is a symbol of the individual quietly restoring himself because he is in an atmosphere that is real. We are all suffering from false atmospheres and false dedications, and therefore the monk goes out in the Zen tradition and sits under a tree somewhere and just sees things as they are. He also becomes aware of the comparative unimportance of himself. He sees that he is only a part of something so much bigger that he is hardly a gnat in the sunbeam. He is sitting quietly watching the universe move around him, and he is part of that universe. He comes and goes with the seasons. He sees beauty. He can protect it to some degree. He becomes infinitely aware of little things, and these are so often the basis of well-being. Happiness does not always come from a great achievements, but from little things. And most of the little things that bring happiness come to us as love, as affection, as a kind of inner understanding, a wonderful sympathy with life. So to the little monk sitting under the tree in the Chinese painting, the sympathy with life is all important. The individual feels himself as part of something. And in feeling it, he feels more than this kinship. He feels something a little more important than that. He feels that this kinship carries with it the rules of conduct. That this sympathy and kinship is a way of life in itself. A way of life that it shares in the mystery of life everlasting, that it shares in the way of solution, that it is our only hope of individual security or world peace. Somewhere along the line, kindness must come into birth, and there's never been an absence of it. The seed of kindness is in the hearts and souls of everything that lives. It is part of our life. It is part of all the good that exists in the world. But we have to call it forth by some kind of magic, and that magic is love. Nothing else will bring it out of the deep caves where it has hidden itself against the sorrows, pressures, and glooms of the day. Now, in our particular moment where we're living now, we are probably under greater stress than most people have ever experienced in this life, and perhaps have never experienced in previous lives. This is an extremely critical period. It is a period in which there must be an awakening. This awakening has to come. Otherwise, there will be no solution to the fact that man can become ever more dangerous to himself. The solution has to be, as the Buddha says, in the coming of the Maitreya Buddha, the coming of the spirit of kindness, the spirit of being gentle, the spirit of protecting life, of finding ways to arbitrate difficulties, and also to practice the great virtues of unselfishness and modesty and humility that are part of our divine inheritance. Actually, the human being, because the human being is by nature divine, is an extremely simple creature. We like to think of the human being as terribly complicated. And we think of God as terribly complicated. But to the mystic, both God and man are very simple creatures. A deity has the simplicity of absolute perfection, the simplicity of living forever in love and truth. We don't have to think of God going to school. We don't have to think of all the different things we have to do to try to learn to be decent citizens as necessary to the archangels. We assume that these beings, in the simple goodness of things, as Aquinas has pointed out, that actual goodness, true goodness, is an open door to the infinity of knowing. There is nothing that can be concealed from the good, and nothing that can be revealed through the evil. Therefore, by the simple process of being good, simple people, we accomplish the destiny of the God within us. It is a simple relationship between that which is eternally quiet and the quietude that we seek every day. It is not a power like deity thundering out in the silences and pointing his finger accusingly at us. We point our fingers accusingly at each other and occasionally pointed them in his direction. But actually, deity never works except through love. Every correction that we get is given beautifully if we'll accept it. Everything that we have to change can be changed beautifully, because the law of existence is so organized that this can be occurred, can occur. There is no need at any time for violence or frustration or the individual to get angry at himself or curse heaven because things do not go well. Actually, they do not go well because the individual has no acceptance of the importance of affections and sympathies in living. I know we find in art a good deal of thought of this nature. The great artists of the past were mostly self-trained, had a little knowledge maybe of the palette from some predecessor, but for the most part, the beautiful things that we see came directly from themselves, or they came through themselves, probably would be a little more honorable way of describing it. Raphael, his magnificent paintings flowed through himself. And every human being is a potential Raphael. We think of scientists and philosophers and skilled people in all fields, and we think that they are all individuals. Every skill in the world is a manifestation of the one divine skill that is at the source of existence. All skill, all beauty, all truth, all hope, all love, all these together come from one source, and each is an expression. Each is like a priest in a house, a part of a great religious unity each with a special labor, each with a special service to render, each one capable of doing a particular thing. And Kipling, in one of his poems, says, "And each on his separate star, painting the thing as he sees it, for the God of things as they are." And this is another thing we all have to learn, that we are not always to judge people as to whether they agree with us or not, or whether we agree with them, or whether their arts are of any interest to us, or whether their sciences touch us. These are not important. All forms of knowledge ultimately contribute to the perfection of man, but they also contribute to man's infinite relationship with deity. Therefore, everything that is worthwhile, everything that is good, is part of a tremendous pageantry of dedications. I wish we could find some way to inspire people to have an experience of simple affection. It probably is still obtainable to most people in one way or another. Something in which love comes out from you without hope of reward. Something that makes you feel a kinship with life, a recognition of proximity to something greater than yourself. Something that you meet with sympathy only and not with criticism. Something you do not estimate intellectually and find wanting. Just simple experience of a devotion or the exhilaration of a simple acceptance of nature's joys, nature's beauties, nature's wonders. Sit down sometime, perhaps, in a garden and just look a few flowers. Or go out by the side of a river and watch the waters and the trees. Do what the Chinese do. Simply relax into a mood of a beautiful world. If enough people do this, it will have a great effect, as asymmetry and discord and dissonance do damage. And this is one of the problems of our entertainment field today, which has lost all sense of the joy of beauty, or the oneness of the divine plan of things. But it's possible for the person to find in something simple, something not maybe more than a sunrise, or a kindly word from a friend, or a smile from a child, something that simply makes the heart move, makes you kind of glad inside, and causes you to smile back, causes you to have the same feeling, in a spontaneous exchange of goodness. So these types of moods can become a meditational process with people if they want it to. They can become parts of a daily experience of never seeing things but seeing into things, never judging from surfaces but searching for substances and depths, and in problems of relationship, never coming to a hasty judgment, trying to understand other people rather than to be willing to go on misunderstanding them forever. Some kind of an experience in which love of that which is better comes through each of us is so much better than the kind of affection that we use when we say, "I just loved lunch." This is the wrong approach to things. It is probable that lunch might be likable, but the word love is reserved for something that is a deep universal reality, something that deserves real attention, real consecration. The power to love is in everything. Sometimes it is killed by an incident. Sometimes it is destroyed by a moment. Sometimes it takes years to recover from a disillusionment. But in all of these things, the person should look inside of himself. If he is dragging along with him attitudes and feelings that are not affectionate, that are not kindly, that are not charitable, he should do something about that. Or if he has been deficient in the kun-non quality, compassion. Compassion for the weak. Compassion for the helpless. compassion for those younger forms of life that are growing up in the midst of our difficult days. Compassion for everything that is good, and a great willingness to sacrifice something of the immediate pleasure for an ultimate joy arising from the things that we do that are right. So we can work with these problems a little bit and gradually discover what we should have learned from other lessons. Suppose we have had a bad experience, a badly broken home, or some very difficult pattern in life, and we have never forgotten it and it's never ceased to hurt us. That is an incident right there which is a tremendous opportunity. Let us try to study the situation more carefully than we normally do. If the disaster hit, to what degree were each of those involved in the disaster? What did we all do that was wrong? Why did we not do this or that? And most of all, was this disaster the result of the failure of love? Was there ulterior motive in the love as we thought we expressed it? Did we marry for security and not for love? Did we marry for passing pleasures and happiness and not for the great serious relationships of good? Did we marry only outwardly, but never inwardly? Were we willing to drift along, each living his own life, cherishing freedom above all other things? In the Eastern philosophies, there is no freedom except in love. There is no freedom from love. That which we try to escape in thinking that we are running away from love cannot be that. It must be something else. Because love does not hurt. And if it is sincere, there are always solutions. And if there is no other solution, there is always the possibility of a different degree of love, which we call friendship. And things that are not compatible can remain friends forever, if each in its own turn gives the other the right to convictions that are natural and reasonable. All the way along, then we have health problems also that cause us to be a little doubtful about the value of providence. Yet all these problems have to be faced. And life, in some mysterious way, does pay us constructively for the things that we do well. In all the emergencies of life, if we've done our best, there seems to be a great probability that heaven will be kind. The trouble that we mostly have is that we leave this world with too much unfinished business. Business that we can't finish here and was of no value to us anywhere else. We leave here without actually learning to love the world or the life within ourselves or those around us or the great beauties of nature. We just go smaller and smaller until finally we drop out, mostly centered upon ourselves. The individual so-centered is missing everything. If we love ourselves, we will do those things which make the self good. If we love ourselves, we will be lovable people to all others. And where we try to simply develop an emotional satisfaction out of things that have no value, then we will have to face the consequences that these emotions are disturbed, betrayed, or injured. Wrong emotions have to be corrected. And every ulterior motive in emotional living is a mistake and must be paid for. Every time in which we use anything wrong, if we do not obey the divine plan of things in all that we do, there's going to be trouble. Whereas if we try to grow sincerely every day, we will find that most of the antagonisms and animosities that we have feared will fade away and not bother us anymore. So love is a healing thing. Most of the miseries of the soul are due to the fact we have not learned to love, that we have learned to hope that somebody is going to love us, but we have not yet been able to forget the selfish side of our natures long enough to cooperate with those in need or those who we can serve and help. An example, of course, like Dr. Schweitzer, is a good case at point. He had the common problem of usefulness. He became a medical missionary. In other words, he served God by serving the natives of Gabon in Africa. He gave his life as a religious act, a dedication to the service of those who need. Love is also always dedication. It is dedication to something greater than we are. It is dedication to God through some necessity of man, something that man can do to help God. Not because God, in the last analysis, needs help, because deity is all sufficient. But we can help God by helping man to find God. And we do this by making people say of him, he was a good man. He served others. He was helpful. He gave a life of dedication. The world honors him, but not enough people follow his example. And it is the following of the example that makes all things come true. So if you love, become skillful enough to serve intelligently those that you do love. If you love God, serve God in a gentle, kindly way, without frustrations or inhibitions, and without hope of reward. The final reward for love is to be loved. And this is something that very few people really earn the right to. Therefore, they think they're loved, and then they're betrayed. They think they have found a friend, but the friend fades out. And all of these failures are simply due to the lack of a level of integrities. To go back to the Neoplatonists that we started out with, it is to be remembered that they made a classification, a ladder of affections, showing each rung of the ladder and how the individual climbs from the most primitive isolation to utter unity. And as the world in the same way must climb from nationalism to internationalism, must rise from racialism to interracialism, and rise from all kinds of religions to the one final faith, faith based upon the love of God and the service of each other. If we can get these points a little bit more firmly in our hearts and minds, I think in time we'll all be a lot happier, and things in the world will go better. Oh, thank you very much.